Hello and welcome to Armenian News Network Krung. This week in review, we talk with Hrant Mikhaelian to discuss important issues and developments around Armenia, such as the coronavirus pandemic and its economic effect, Armenia's membership in the Eurasian Economic Union and the economic effect of that organization on Armenia, and some of the trends affecting Russia and its economy. Hrant will then join us in our weekly lightning round of questions from the past week's headlines to analyze Prime Minister Pashinyan's interview with BBC's Hard Talk, the presidential elections in Belarus, and the continuing standoff at Al-Musar gold mine between Lydian and local residents and environmental activists. Hello, everyone. Today we have with us Hrant Mikhaelian. He was born in Tbilisi and is a political scientist and multidisciplinary researcher in social sciences based in Yerevan. Hrant is also a senior researcher at the Caucasus Institute. We're going to be talking broadly about Armenia's response to the pandemic and the economic response, both by Armenia and its neighbors. Hrant, welcome and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Thank you.
So before we jump to the main questions, Hrant, I'd like to say that I try to follow your writings closely on the Caucasian Out website. You do produce a large number of articles, and they're very rich in analytical content. But I think there is a large segment of the Krung audience that you may not be reaching, since your writings are mostly in Russian. Lately, I've been trying to post your articles on Krung and to provide a link to Google Translate, but automatic translations don't always work out. Do you have plans to tailor your content to readers who don't read Russian?
Thank you, first of all, regarding the content. Not yet. Maybe through the media content like this, maybe, because I have also a program on radio where I talk in Armenian, maybe mostly on the same issues. So, in some regard, with your help, I will do that.
Great. Looking forward to it. So you've written a number of articles about this topic. So let's begin with coronavirus. What is your outlook on the progression of coronavirus in Armenia? And what are the current trends that you're observing?
Let me try to present the context under which I see it. Of course, I'm not an epidemiologist and I cannot do very good epidemiological models because it's not my primary area of research. At the same time, I do demographic research, I do statistical research and the social sciences, and it gives me a possibility to analyze what's going on in this regard, because regarding coronavirus, we have a lot of data, and we have a lot of data both in Armenia and especially from outside, so we can study the issue on statistical level. So this gives me a possibility to do that. And given that there are not too many researches on it, I'm trying to fill the gap somehow, and mainly from the demographic perspective. So first of all, what we see is that its spread reached a peak in June, and after that it was on decline. I'm talking about registered numbers. I also have a reconstruction of the real trend, and it gives me a bit different picture, but generally it's different in numbers. It shows that probably about 7% of people in Armenia could have contracted coronavirus, so up to 200,000 people could have immunity as of now. Apart from that, what we see regarding the trend is that it's on decline already, and we have in 1 week, last week, we have about 190 cases a day, I mean registered cases, which is 3.5 times less than on peak. But it's also important to note that the decrease has stopped during last week. So we came to some, let's say, lower plateau, and at this moment we are stuck there on 190 cases a day.
Do you believe there is some sort of a periodicity to these numbers? For instance, everyone is talking about first wave and the second wave. What are your thoughts about that?
Of course, I cannot be sure, because there is not enough data globally and in Armenia as well. But from what we know, in some countries, there is already a second wave starting, and it is connected to periodicity. So they are... I've read several articles by epidemiologists and virusologists who say that this virus might have periodicity. There were several scientific publications that it's, let's say, afraid of sun. So when we have an intense sun in summer, its spread is decreasing. This is what we observe in Armenia. Now, the question is, if the weather starts changing especially beginning in November. Will the trend change? That I, of course, cannot say for sure, but I assume that it will. We have second wave starting in France. We have it in Israel. In Israel, it's not connected to the weather. It's more connected to the management, but still. So I think there is a risk at least, and this risk should be taken into account and should be approached as serious risk that we can have second wave because we have not first wave completely finished. Also, what is important that I'm not sure that we have clear understanding of that in the country because many think we have already achieved herd immunity, which is not a fact.
Okay. As of last week, according to Worldometers, for countries with greater than 1 million population, Armenia is number 10 in terms of cases per 1 million people, with roughly 14,000 cases per 1 million. However, it is number 50 in terms of testing, having done roughly 60,000 tests per 1 million. Are Armenia's testing levels adequate, and how do they compare with our neighbors?
I don't think they are adequate enough. There is an indicator test positivity rate, which is ratio of total of positive rates to total number of tests. So we see that almost one in four tests, which have been conducted in Armenia from the beginning, gave positive result, which means that we do very little number of tests. In reality, to catch all the cases, Armenia needs to do about at least 50 tests per one positive. That's what shows the international experience. If we assume that we have 200 cases a day, then we need 10,000 tests, not 1,300 or 1,400, which we usually have. So we do not do enough tests. And I'm sure that if we have done more tests, we would have more cases. Moreover, we are not even able to catch all death cases. That's also because of poor testing.
So what do you think are the reasons for this? Is there any health policy framework where not doing aggressive testing makes sense?
I think the reason is that the government tries to save the money. It's just a matter of economy. And in this matter, I think this is miscalculation because in reality, if we do aggressive testing, we will be able to preserve economy on the higher profile because what we see from the spread of virus globally is that it's not the lockdown itself which harms the economy, but it's the spread of virus because people limit their activities anyway. People limit their movement activities, their purchases of goods, of services. So unless you combat virus effectively, you have economy contracted. For example, if you look at South Korea case, you see that aggressive testing there gave good results. Now here we don't do that probably because of economic reasons, but in reality, after that, as a result of that, we have even more economy contracting. If we compare Armenia to the neighbors, Georgia has 4,000 tests daily and only 20 positive cases, up to 20 positive cases. So they have 200 tests per one case. And as I said, in Armenia, we have 4 to 5 tests per one positive.
Thanks. Prime Minister Pashinyan recently stated that Armenia's government commitment of 300 million has already been dispersed as part of 23 separate programs. And the latest one came this week in support of agriculture and tourism. How would you evaluate Armenia's financial response so far, if you have an opinion on that? And how targeted, for instance, were these programs in your opinion? And is it possible to compare Armenia's response to coronavirus with the larger region?
If we compare Armenia in terms of economic or financial reaction to the coronavirus with the developed countries, of course, we see that Armenia's allocated resources are not enough. Many developed countries have introduced in reality the universal basic income or something comparable to it, for example, Germany or United States. But on the other hand, if we count the figures which Armenian government was able to allocate, I think they were spent more or less rationally and effectively because They were targeted. There were different programs which were imposed for the most vulnerable sectors and groups of people. So I think in this regard, Armenian government has tried to do its best to spend these amounts as efficiently as possible.
And finally, on the topic of coronavirus, what is your prediction for the COVID-19 impact on Armenia's economy for this year and the following year?
From the beginning, I was mostly optimistic about economic impact of COVID on Armenian economy. First of all, because I didn't know how fast it will spread in Armenia and how far it will spread. But apart from that, it was also based on a preposition that Armenia's economy's vulnerabilities towards external crisis are not that big, because Armenia's tourism is important for the economy, but not as important as, for example, for Georgia. And the Armenian labor market has been recently less vulnerable. Also, Armenian exports is not that much dependent on oil prices or commodity prices as, for example, Azerbaijan. So Armenia is nominally, at least, less vulnerable to the global crisis than its neighbors. But what we saw in reality was that vulnerability was rather big, and that economy contracted much. If in the beginning of the year we had 9% growth of the economy, then in April we had minus 16, so the delta is 25. So in April, the real economic decline was almost 25%. It was short term, because in June we had already just 5% decline, but it's still big, especially given that we had big track of growth in the beginning of the year. So now it's very hard to predict what will happen in the end of the year. There are different predictions in the field done by international organizations or local economists, between 3 and 10% decline. So I would say probably something in the middle, let's say minus 6 or 7%, would be the most realistic outcome. But I can't say for sure, because what we know is the extent of impact which it had on Armenian economy as of now. But what we don't know is the issue of second wave, vaccine, and so on. So these things might affect Armenian economy and will affect the rates of growth. Also, what we don't know, how other countries will approach Armenia. For example, will they open borders with Armenia or no? That we also don't know. So we can only have guesses, not actual predictions, not calculations, let's say.
And do you think that the economic decline will also continue in 2021?
I believe after March, or after February 2021, we will not have economic decline, at least because of a low base effect, which we have accumulated because of pandemic and lockdown. But it again depends on the second wave issue and stuff like that. So generally, either we will have rather high rates of economic growth if we have combated effectively with the virus, or we will have low rates of economic growth if we continue living in the regime like this, like what we have now.
Next, I'd like to jump to Armenia's northern neighbor, Russia. And in a recent interview on Lelat Vakan Radio, you predicted that Russia is heading towards economic collapse. Could you give us more details behind your bleak prediction?
I've talked to different people also after that interview, because there were different opinions on whether I was right or wrong. But what I understood from that, and what I understand generally about Russian economy, is that Russia does not have clear trend towards growth, long term, not even small growth. That is big trouble for Russia. Another problem is that Russia does not grow for already, in reality, 30 years. Because at 2008, Russia has achieved its pre-Soviet Union collapse level of size of GDP. Then it has contracted in 2009 and 2015. And then it has grown again, but still it's somewhere near 1989 level, which is very problematic. So in relative terms, Russia has lived through big economic decline. Now, concerning the future, Russia has several major problems, I think. First is that its economy is hurt by sanctions. In reality, the impact is rather big. From what I looked at, different studies have done by the economists using synthetic control methods and something like that, we can say that about 2% a year, Russian economy is declining because of sanctions, or at least its growth is lower than it would be expected. 2% a year is rather big. Then Russia is still vulnerable to oil prices shocks and generally commodities markets, because most of its export is commodities, it's metals, oil and gas and stuff like that. That's the second major problem of Russia. Third is that it's a very hardly centered economy and state at all. Because if you look, for example, at the United States, you have head offices of big corporations in elsewhere. Some would be in Seattle or nearby, some would be in California, some would be in New York, and etc. In Russia, you don't have that. In Russia, everything is concentrated in Moscow, which is big trouble. And then the government policies. A government doesn't have clear vision of future, does not propose it to the people, and there are not even real alternative projects. So I don't see a good alternative project to what government does. So I don't see really how Russia could go through that economically. Hopefully I'm wrong, but I really don't see that.
Hrant, I have a follow-up question on that. When we talk about the Russian economy, primarily we're talking about a resource export economy. In the last 30 years, and particularly in the last 10 years, when you talked about contractions in 2008, 2015, what has Russia done to diversify its economy and start a services-based sector and move away from just oil exports and gas exports?
Russia tried to diversify, but they don't really understand that they should go towards, let's say, services sector. They generally see two competing models. The capitalism as they have seen it in the 90s and the socialism as they have seen it in the 1970s. So this government has mainly formed, the personalities have mainly formed in 1970s. So in reality, they are going back. They are recreating big industries. They are recreating industrial plants in different fields. So this is the way they are trying to diversify the economy. And this is not really working because still the industry doesn't have as big added value. I would say you should work on industry if you want to go on, but services are not very, very well developed in Russia. And also what is major problem of Russia is that what they see as an ideal model is big companies-based economy. So they push small and medium enterprises to very bad situation, let's say.
Does Russia have an IT industry or a biotech industry? I'm interested because we also heard just in this last week that Russia was the first to register a vaccine for the coronavirus, and Vladimir Putin's daughter has already taken this vaccine.
Yes, they said they have it. Then I looked, there is, if I'm not mistaken, on New York Times, the COVID vaccine tracker, and it turned out that there are 10 more vaccines, which are more advanced than the Russian one. I mean, officially. So it's, in some terms, yes, they still have something, especially what they have preserved from the Soviet times, because Russia had, in biotech, Russia had all these bioweapons programs or bio-counter-weapons programs. Mainly it was military, which they were developing in the Soviet times, and they are still developing the biotech on the base of that programs. Now, regarding IT, they have it. They have it developed in the 90s. They have several major companies like, let's say, Yandex or some else. But they were mainly progressing those companies in the late 90s and beginning of 2000s, maybe until 2007 or 8, but not after that. So they have also stuck. And another their problem is that because of political sanctions on Russia or politically motivated economic sanctions, their market is decreasing. Ukraine has completely closed its market for Russian IT products, and not only Ukraine in reality. So for them, there are two major problems: the economic policy of the state in Russia, and second is the sanctions again.
Rand, you recently wrote about the vulnerabilities of the Eurasian Economic Union, where you highlighted Russia's dominant role in that organization. Given that Armenia is part of EAEU, we are very interested in, you know, how this organization is going to develop. So what do you think, how will Russia's potential economic troubles affect the EAEU? And what do you see in general as the future of that union?
Well, one of the major problems which EU faces right now is that it's less interest from Russian side towards the union. Because if you are a major player in the union, you have to finance it. This is the way the unions work. If you look at the European Union, lately there were some figures published, you would see that France and Germany finance it. If you look at, let's say, US-based unions, maybe at NATO, it's of course a different thing, but still, you would see that the major player is the driver of the union. Now, Russia is withdrawing from its role in the Eurasian Economic Union, and of course it affects the union badly. If we look at the policies which are imposed in other member states, for those countries, for the bureaucracy of those countries, the Eurasian Union is more important than for Russia, because in Russia you would see very minor role in the bureaucratic, in the government of the policies regarding the Eurasian Union, which is not the case for other members. So this is a big problem for development of Eurasian Economic Union, and especially in terms of pandemic. Because if we look how, for example, European Union was handling the pandemic, we would see that in the beginning, it was problematic for European Union as well, because it was not very, let's say, quick to response. But at least now, while countries are trying to economically restore their potential, European Union is there and it's active player. But Eurasian Economic Union was neither active while the, let's say, virus stage of pandemic, nor in the economic recovery. So this is main vulnerability for Eurasian Economic Union. On the other hand, still for Armenia, it is beneficial, because I've calculated the net effect of Eurasian Economic Union's market for Armenia, and it's about 1.5% of additional GDP growth a year. So in last 6 years, we already got almost $1 to $1.5 billion in our GDP. So it's almost 10%.
Rant, is the Eurasian Union inactive as a result of Russia's economic problems?
Generally, yes, and also because of its own institutional weakness. If you have a union where one country constitutes 80% of population, economy, and other fields, it's very hard if this country is not very, very willing to develop it, that you would see any development. And in reality, Russian interest towards Eurasian Economic Union was weak from the beginning, because Eurasian Economic Union was built around the idea of integrating Ukraine into Russian-led policies. So since Ukraine is out, it's already very hard to speak about any kind of Eurasian Union future. Now, you also asked about Russian economic decrease since 1989. I meant current Russia. If you compare Russian economic potential to the economic potential of the Soviet Union, it's completely incomparable. Soviet Union at some point was 14% of global GDP. Russia is now about 2%.
Thank you, Eran. Just to wrap up, given this information, is there any takeaway that Armenia has from this? How should Armenia craft its policy towards this organization to maximize its benefits?
I think Armenia has several things to do. First of all, Armenia has developed several industries. If in Russia it is highly manufacturing and hard industries-based economy. Then in Armenia, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was mainly trade and services-based economy and, to a big extent, agriculture. So Armenia lacked industrial development. So this is what Armenia can get there. And we have already grown light industries, I mean, footwear or clothes industry, which was mainly this industry has grown in last 6-7 years, and mainly based on opening Eurasian market. But after it's created, after the new factories have been created, new working places have been created, Armenia can also start learning how to enter European market as well. Because if you have already an industrial enterprise, it also can open a line for, let's say, for European market, for US market, for Asian markets, and so on. So this is first thing. Another thing is that despite, as I said, there is low interest from Russian side towards the Eurasian Union development, it's still for Armenia matter of institutional development, because its bureaucracy is competent, and the reforms which Eurasian Union adopted have affected in some fields Armenia's position in economic freedom index and in doing business index. So it's also beneficial from institutional point of view. And the third is more attention towards Armenia generally, because being locked in the high mountains let's say, borderlands of Middle East, Mediterranean or Caucasus, it's very hard to attract any interest to the country at all. So what Armenia can see from Eurasian Union is that it can host some summits. Yes, those summits are not that big, but still something, as it did in October 2019. It can attract some more interest from both Eurasian region, from Asian region, from European region. So Armenia should play on that, I think, because Armenia also has a GSP plus regime, trade regime with the EU. Armenia has good relations with Iran, with Georgia, and almost open trade with Georgia. Also, it has a GSP trading regime with United States. So having all those directions open, Armenia should try to combine them. And being a Eurasian Union member, which has no conflict with the West, is a benefit which Armenia could try to use. But here it's very important to construct very competent foreign policy, which Armenia, both competent and proactive, which Armenia has always lacked. So I think Armenia has to use all its potential, also intellectual potential, to try to capitalize on that. And this is a possibility also.
Thank you, Hrant, for this fascinating conversation. Our time is up, but I really hope we can have you on in the future. And thanks for your time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Welcome back for our lightning round of headlines from the past week. I'm Aspet Bedrosyan, and I'm joined today by our panelists, Aspet Kochigyan, Hrant Mikhaelian is joining us, Artyom Donoyan, and Alen Zamanyan. Aspet Kochigyan is a senior lecturer of political science and international relations at Bentley University in Massachusetts, where he teaches courses on the Middle East and former Soviet space, and with expertise in judicial reform, ways to combat radicalization and on ethnic and religious minorities. Hrant Mikhaelian is a political scientist and multidisciplinary researcher in social sciences based in Yerevan. Hrant is also a senior researcher at the Caucasus Institute. Artyom Donoyan is research associate at the University of Minnesota's Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies, where his research is focused on the nexus of religion and violence. His specialties include religion and politics in the Caucasus and religion and nationalism in Russia. Alen Zamanyan is a software engineer in Los Angeles who follows and has analyzed Armenian affairs for over a decade. Hello and welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hello, Aspet. Thank you for having us.
I want to start with Prime Minister Pashinyan's interview with Hard Talk on BBC. Aspet Kochigyan, what was your reaction to the interview? How did Pashinyan perform? What can you set this up for us?
Well, in order to evaluate the performance, you have to understand what is the theatrics, let's put it that way, if we're talking about performance. Hard Talk is not a journalistic interview. It's an interrogation. That's the style. So in order to respond to what you ask, basically we need to understand the format of the talk. And provocative questions, sometimes condescending, and more often than not, trying to get a strong reaction from the interviewee. I think within the last 11 months, 10 months, this is the second interview that Hard Talk has been having. The first was in October with Foreign Minister Mnatsaganyan and now with Pashinyan. I think all in all, Prime Minister Pashinyan should have declined because there is nothing added, no value added from these interviews. I think there is a perception. Probably the Hard Talk format is very similar, I would put it, as the journalism that exists in Armenia, in the sense that you're not after facts, you're not after elucidation, you're just after provocation. But then at the end of the day, it is the BBC, so you have that allure. And all in all, I felt that the goal of PRing, if you want to call it, was not achieved. Going back to history, bringing history as an example, or speaking over each other, that's the norm that happens. But it was the 20 minutes of fame, 20 minutes of perception. And from perspective of Armenia, regardless of what they would say, oh, look, you know, our prime minister was on the BBC Hard Talk. So in and by itself, it is a major event. We're being put on the map. But at the end of the day, the language, first of all, I don't think Prime Minister Pashinyan has enough of a language, English language skills to relay complex and multi-nuanced issues, which is needed in this case. But it was just a showmanship, I think, at both ends.
Artyom, how did you feel about Pashinyan's attitude, presence, preparation? And do you agree that he should have declined this interview?
Osved, pretty much hit the nail over the head. He said everything that was, in my assessment, it was a very correct assessment of Pashinyan's performance. I don't think he has the linguistic acuity or the preparedness that is demanded of such a high-profile interview. He came to a boxing ring without gloves, and I think it was a dismal performance. He didn't have anything new to say. He fell back on old cliches that gave talking points to Azerbaijani propagandists. If you look social media run by Azeri government actors, basically everyone that I have followed or I'm looking at are elated at the performance of Pashinyan. He was unable to drive home some very basic points, and when he was trying to drive home those points, he was flubbing. He was not coherent. For instance, when it came to the issue of Armenians shelling Azeri villages, and this was presented by the interviewer as the instigation for an Azerbaijani tit for tat. I mean, an absolutely false assumption to begin with. We don't know who started what. And so my assessment of Pashinyan is not in any way celebratory. It was a terrible performance on an international stage, and he should know his capacity before he goes into a match like that. I think he did it for his base, so to speak, another video for his Facebook feed.
Harant, what do you make of it? What's your reaction to this interview?
Generally, I, of course, agree with the colleagues, but let me add some points. It could be, I'm not sure, but still theoretically, that the fact that Armenian leaders are not afraid of participating at Hard Talk, while, let's say, for example, Azerbaijani leadership does not do that and probably is afraid, maybe gives some advantage, because at least, of course, the performance was not perfect at all, but at least they tried. Another thing is that generally in Armenia, it's a very weak culture of debates, and this Hard Talk is good time to see it. And of course, for Pashinyan, it's also very hard to help debates, because usually he is speaking while others listen. And now it's time when he needs to have debates. And also, we can remember, for example, his debate with Aliyev in February, which I think was not also at good level. Another issue is that he had to prepare better. Of course, linguistical skills, it's hard to change quickly, but at least he could prepare better in terms of text. However, at the same point, I think he performed better than in February, And also, I think he performed better than his foreign minister. So at least I think we have some progress in terms of governmental approach towards the issue. That's first, because usually beforehand, 1 year before or at the time, he would say that, oh, we don't know what the Karabakh issue is, yes, yet we should understand it. So I hope at least now they understood. So generally, I would say that at least at some point, it's that Pashinyan does not afraid to go there, and in some terms, it's beneficial.
Thank you, Hrant. Well, I'm going to take a somewhat contrarian view to what I've heard many of you say. I think it takes a lot of balls for Prime Minister Pashinyan to give an interview on Hard Talk, but we know he doesn't shrink away from a fight. I think he did pretty well, given that his English was his biggest weakness here, demonstrated, for example, when he flubbed the Armenian demographics in Artsakh to be 19 or 18% when the conflict erupted, when he really meant to say 90 or 80%. Hard Talk is known for bullying small countries and being deferential to larger ones. They've interviewed Turkey's Erdogan at least twice, and not once have they asked him if he'd apologize for the Armenian genocide. Is that really Hard Talk? And Azerbaijan's Aliyev has declined to interview with them. Would they ask Aliyev if he's ready to apologize for deporting 250,000 Armenians from Baku and Sumgait 30 years ago? Would he apologize for failing to achieve peace for 17 years, 30, counting his father's time? Would he apologize for stashing Azerbaijan's national wealth in his daughter's secret Panama accounts? Would he apologize for trying to restart the war in April 2016 or July 2020? He started all these wars. So when Sakir says that Pashinyan has failed to achieve peace, the Prime Minister should have told him that it takes two sides to want peace. He has nothing to apologize for. I think the Prime Minister was soft on Stephen Sakir, letting him get away with falsely premised questions when often it sounded like the BBC's research came from Azeri propaganda sources. He should have never accepted the question from a source which he considers unreliable or biased. But as for his responses, his temperament, his presence, I thought Pashinyan did generally pretty well.
Yeah, it's interesting that there are a lot of common denominators among all the panelists or among all the people here talking. One thing, again, I want to emphasize that this is not an interview. This is an interrogation. Had there been, by a miracle, an interview with Aliyev, I think Stephen Sakir would have asked him questions that Armenian would say, ah, see, changing our agenda. This is, again, as I said, I think to a large extent, getting reactions, provoking and getting reactions rather than understanding issues in details and in depth. And how much information can you get about 5-6 topics in a matter of 20 minutes talking with a head of a government? That being said, strategically, I think Prime Minister Pashinyan had an opportunity to prepare for the last 11 months for this kind of an interview, you know, looking at Foreign Minister Manatsaganyan's experience. And he had some reactions. For instance, at some point when Sakir mentioned that Human Rights Watch argues that Armenia there have been violations of rights and so on and so forth in Armenia, Pashinyan came back by saying, but Freedom House says otherwise. That's the kind of reaction you would see or expect from anyone who's being interviewed, that instead of going back into history, talking about essence, you just listen, you just give back, and just wait. You don't go over. And that actually would have a better PR, better influence or better impact on the listeners or the viewers who might not be vested in this issue at all.
Thank you, everyone. Let's talk about the presidential elections in Belarus on August 9. Alexander Lukashenko won his re-election with 80% of the vote. Immediately afterwards, protests and violence broke out in many cities around the country. And to date, over 6,000 have been arrested, over 700 detained, and the president of Lithuania has publicly declared Lukashenko no longer a legitimate leader. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Pashinyan and President Sarkisian instantly congratulated Lukashenko, and Pashinyan has been getting slammed for his hasty recognition of the results of this unfair election by opposition Bright Armenia and human rights activists in the country. What's going on in Belarus, and why are we seeing these dynamics in Armenia in response to that? Artyom, do you want to take this?
Oh, what's going on in Belarus? That's a question of biblical proportions. Obviously, the situation in Belarus is very fluid. It can get out of control really quickly. And Lukashenko, you know, when you have been in power for so long, you start believing yourself to be invincible. And there were moments that were pretty much dynamic during the previous elections in Belarus, during presidential elections previously and the parliamentary elections. But nobody expected that the situation will grow to become ever so dangerous for Lukashenko. He had come to believe that his power was safe, that the rigged elections were good enough to blow smoke in people's direction, and people will forget and go home. I think he's making the same strategic mistake as Yanukovych when he dismissed the opposition and then started suppressing them in 2014. And we have what we have. We had Maidan, we had unnecessary bloodshed, and so on and so forth. In terms of what's going to happen, it's all going to be a matter of speculation, but the boat has been rocked. The Tsar no longer feels safe on his throne. And as we saw in the news today, he had a conversation with Vladimir Putin, presenting the situation in Belarus as a potential portent to how things will develop in Russia if Russia does not come to Lukashenko's aid. So the situation is quite tinderboxy, for lack of a better word. And hopefully there will be no more bloodshed, and hopefully Lukashenko will come to realize that his days are numbered, and he will put the interests of the people of Belarus above his own interest and the interest of his family and his cronies.
Thank you. Hrant, what do you make of the Belarus situation?
I've been 5 to 6 times to Belarus in the last 11 years. So what I saw there is that it is a model of ideal Soviet Union, which was never a case in the Soviet Union itself due to many restrictions and problems. But it was created in Belarus after the collapse of the actual Soviet Union. But ideal Soviet Union model is still problematic in many regards. So Belarus stopped growing economically 8 years ago. So it was a bit increasing, then decreasing. So generally it has grown just 5% after 2011 economically. The model has, let's say, exalted itself. In Belarus, in 1988 to 1991, there was no major anti-communist movement. So what I see there is that this, let's say, collapse of the Soviet Union, which did not take place in Belarus at that time, is happening now. And if you look at the demographic profile of protesters, all of them are young. It's new generation, which was mainly born after Lukashenko was already in power, or at least they have grown up under himself in the power. But it's a post-Soviet generation. Another thing, there are many aspects to the story. The elections were not even falsified, because you falsify if you have 1,000 votes and you add some 100 votes for, let's say, incumbent. But there it was just drones. They have drawn some picture which has no connection to the reality. But real results would give Lukashenko somewhere in between 30 and 60, and some statistical reconstructions give him about 45%, which means that there would be second tour, or maybe he just lost in the first tour. Now, one minor thing. Why they acted so violently, the authorities? It was an approach, a perception in the elite, in Belarusian elite, that Belarusian people is afraid of blood, of clashes, and if there are some clashes, they will go away. That was their common impression before the events. So they have created these clashes by themselves on their side, the authorities. And what is new is that people don't go away. This is what happened, and afterwards you all know.
Asped, so Belarus is a CSTO member and a Eurasian Economic Association member. And Putin, of course, immediately congratulated Lukashenko as well. And he's probably the 800-pound gorilla here. Where does Belarus go from here?
Well, as Hrant mentioned earlier, again, when it comes to these issues, it's easy to start a revolution or a protest movement. You don't know what direction it would get, what direction it would go to. One of the key aspects here is that issues to keep in mind, and then you can extrapolate from that, again, with limited success, of course, is that A, there is a unified opposition leadership. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, who is sort of the figure or the face of this movement, is actually a good thing in a sense that usually revolutions or protests that have a single unified leadership, they usually have a higher rate of success. Of course, the reaction is also important, as Hrant mentioned. in terms of having using excessive use of force and so on. One thing we need to also keep in mind that the relations that Lukashenko has with Putin have not always been good or have not always been positive. On more than one occasion, and up until now, Putin has always shown a cold shoulder to Lukashenko. So to think that Russia and Belarus are really very close partners is very far from the truth. This in itself can also lead to Belarus being more and more isolated. However, considering that some of the allies or some people who have some vested interest in Russia and Armenia view this as an opportunity to show to Lukashenko that they are a close friend of him individually, the emperor's friend rather than the country's friend. And again, as this is unraveling, it's so difficult to understand or to predict anything. You know, prediction, political scientists like to predict, but, you know, 90% of the cases, you know, there is the human component or unexpected factor that could derail the whole process that you predicted. So from that perspective, I think Lukashenko is strongly in place. He has the power ministries in his hand. And unlike some of the countries, including what happened in Armenia in 2018, or before that, 2003 in Georgia, where the leadership bowed instead of using force, Lukashenko will not hesitate to use force. This is very obvious in many, many cases. A couple of years ago, I was in Belarus, in Minsk, on a consultancy work with an European international organization about their criminal courts and so on, criminal justice and whatnot. And I was shocked as to how blatantly the Belarusian elite or the Belarusian authorities are okay using death penalty or martial law and so on, or without regard or complete disregard of people's rights. So it is a major challenge. It's really, you can scratch your head and, you know, see what's going to happen, talk about what's going to happen. But at the end of the day, I think it's really unraveling on a hour-by-hour basis.
Alan, this week the issue of Amulsar gold mine heated up. As we know, Lydian Armenia filed for bankruptcy about a year ago. Now it's come back as restructured Lydian. Last weekend, they brought in cranes and removed local and environmental activist barracks and moved in their own barracks in order to restart the mining project. But activists and local residents hit back, and I understand they've succeeded in blocking the company again. Can you give us a quick update about this very sensitive matter? What's going on over there?
Maybe I'll start with a brief background. So Lydian is a company that was created in 2006. And at that point, they started exploration in Armenia for gold. And the mining, actually the construction at the Amulsar site started in 2016. And this is a $400 million investment for Lydian. So in 2018, construction was about to wrap up and Lydian was about to start operating the mine. And that's when the events of April 2018 happened, the change of government. In the summer of 2018, protesters started blocking entry for Lydian's machinery to go in there and their personnel to go in and operate the mine. So the main concern that protesters have is they don't want this mine to be operated because of concerns around acid drainage, of the use of cyanide, and proximity to Jermuk and the village of Gündevaz. So there's concerns that they could potentially contaminate and hurt the resort town of Jermuk. Also, there's concern that some of this drainage may enter the two rivers nearby, Arpa and Vorotan, that would then also contaminate Lake Sevan potentially. Lydian has always asserted that there's no real risk there. They did an environmental impact assessment, which environmental activists have a lot of issues with. They believe it doesn't accurately assess the potential risks. Also, in 2018, Nikol Pashinyan, soon after becoming prime minister, he visited and gave a town hall, and he assured everyone that there was going to be a new investigation and they were going to make sure that everything was safe and if it wasn't, that the mine wouldn't operate. In the past year and a half, Lydian obviously was spending $100,000, that's what they claimed, $100,000 a day without actually operating the mine and getting any value from it. So they threatened a few times to take it to international arbitration because they claimed that the Republic of Armenia was not fulfilling its responsibilities according to bilateral investment treaties. But they haven't gone to arbitration yet. They restructured earlier this year. And every few months, this issue flares up because there's on the ground some issue with between the protesters and security forces. That's what happened this time again. The real issue here, I feel like, there's obviously, I would say, three aspects of this. There's the environmental issue, which, I'm not an expert on. There's potentially some risk, but it's a question of how much risk there is. If it's small enough, do we proceed? If not, maybe we take extra measures to minimize the risk and then proceed. There's the legal aspect of it. Lydian obviously has agreements with the Armenian government, and going back on those agreements could have legal implications. And then there's the political aspect of this. Nikol Pashinyan came to power on a popular wave. Everyone was calling for, one of the things they were calling for was, not having these extractive mines and having more inclusive economy. So it's kind of hard for them to, they're kind of paralyzed in a sense. It's hard for them to make a decision to unilaterally, like, say, okay, we're operating this mine, we're going to get rid of the protesters, because it goes against the essence of what the revolution was. I feel like the main issue that protesters have at this point is not even with Lydian. I mean, obviously, that's where the clashes are happening with the security forces. But the main issue they have is with the government of Armenia to make a decision one way or the other. If there are laws that were broken, then that should be addressed. And if not, then, the Armenian government needs to make a decision. This mine is operating or it's not, and follow through on that.
Hovig Manoucharian, we heard that this week some of the investment funding was pulled out of the project. Can you elaborate?
So listening to an interview by one of the members of the legal team for Lydian on, I think it was 168, they did mention that EBRD, along with about 20 or so smaller investors, were restructured out of the project. Not being an expert, I don't know how that would affect their project. But there is the other side where Lydian claims that the other aspect is that Lydian claims that this is not a big deal. The only thing I would like to add as well, I think that to echo Alan, is that it seems that there are multiple aspects, but it seems that this is going to end up being a political issue. I don't see any way, even with five different environmental impact assessments coming after this, I don't see the protesters quieting down on this. And I think they're demanding essentially a political resolution. And it may cost Armenia heavily in international courts.
Well, my main concern is also about the presence of the Armenian government. They seem like they don't want to take any sides. And so they've been kind of a no-show in all these protests. And the latest response that they had given to one of the Armenian media outlets, I think it was 168, was that their position is unchanged. But what it was changed to or unchanged to, we do not know. They've just been a no-show. Harant Mikhailian, do you have any thoughts about this Amulsar project issue?
Well, it's hard to say again on ecological risks, of course, but at least I think we should understand that it's not only gain of economy vs ecology, but it's also economy vs economy, because we have Jermuk, we have waters, spring waters there, we have tourist attractions there, so this is also a balancing risk we should just take into account. Regarding the political issue, Armenian government, as usually, tries to avoid any decision making which might make it unpopular. So it tries to be at this time acceptable for both sides. And as it usually happens with such cases, it turns out not acceptable for any of sides. I think the problem is that it's a very unpopular decision. But on the other hand, I agree with other speakers that Armenia might end up with cards and with possible fines, which can be a major economic problem after that.
So as Hovig said, some of the funding that's getting pulled from the project is to the tune of over $400 million. Just the EBRD is $400 million, but they're not the only investor. Some of the smaller investors are also pulling out. So this is a major hit to the project, even though Lydian itself is downplaying that. We will continue watching this. There's so much more to talk about, but that is all the time we have this week. Thank you, everyone. Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our program. We hope it has helped your understanding of some of the issues from the previous week. We look forward to your feedback and even your suggestions for issues to cover in greater depth. Contact us on our website, groong.org. That's G-R-O-O-N-G. Or on our Facebook page, ANN Groong, or in our Facebook group, Groong Armenian News Network. Please subscribe, like, and share our content on your favorite social media platform to help us reach a wider audience. We are available on most popular platforms, including YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. I'm Hovik Manjaryan, and on behalf of everyone in this episode, I wish you a good week. Thank you for listening, and talk to you next week.